Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. What is it about Halloween? Where do the pumpkins come from and the witches and the bats and the whole idea of trick or treat? The tradition is just one of the many threads in the fabric of American occult and spiritualism. And Mitch Horowitz, author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation, has joined us for another Halloween program to talk about it. Welcome back, Mitch.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So how does all that symbolism come to play in the celebration of Halloween?
You know, it's funny. Halloween wasn't really a mass celebration in this country until after the Second World War. That's when kids began trick-or-treating, and as soon as kids get in on the act, everybody wants to get in on it. But Halloween is really a holiday that was practiced in pre-Christian times by ancient Celts. It was called Swain, and it was a marking of the passage of the fall into winter, and it was a time to honor the spirits of dead ancestors. Towards the Middle Ages, in very late antiquity, in the 900s, going into the turn of the millennium, the holiday got bound up in a Christian celebration that we call All Saints' Day or All Hallows' Eve. So this was a very typical pattern that you find in Western history, where a pagan holiday will get bound up in the calendar with a Christian holiday, and the two become kind of an amalgam or a mixture. So Halloween is really a holiday from the pre-Christian world. We call it Halloween or All Hallows' Eve because that's what the church began to call it when it conflated it with All Saints' Day. But it's really a celebration of a pagan ritual.
Where did the trick-or-treat part come in? Was that, you know, like Brock's candy or something?
Some of those traditions came over from Ireland. I mean, they underwent big changes, you know, carving jack-o'-lanterns, going around from house to house and getting treats. These were things that had been practiced in Ireland. They were carryovers of different variants of this ancient pagan holiday. And they came to America. People embraced them. Obviously, there were huge waves of Irish immigration to this country at different times, especially in the mid-19th century and then again in the early 20th century. And these practices began to spread and disperse throughout the culture. They got commercialized. But some of the things that are most popular at Halloween time, including the carving of jack-o'-lanterns and trick-or-treating, are Irish in nature.
Now, is it celebrated other places?
Yes, but it's not as big a deal. We do everything in the biggest way in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's celebrated, you know, to an extent in Britain, in France, in Ireland, but the celebrations tend to be more religious. They tend to be more bound up with All Saints Day. We do it in the biggest way here.
Well, we do. I remember the old costumes in the box with the plastic mask.
That's right.
And now,
right? Now Captain Marvel and Wonder Woman and so on. Yeah, we brought those to the world.
Those were okay at the time, but now I look back with bitterness. You know, it's nothing compared to what they have now. So, in the book, you mention you talk about witchcraft. And you call it something of a revival or a reinvention of it.
Yep.
After World War II, right around 1951. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it was really incredible. You know, in Great Britain, into the early 1950s, there were still laws against the practice of witchcraft. I mean, this was a real carryover from the witch crazes that had swept through Europe beginning in the Middle Ages. And a group of people who were interested in spiritualism or contacting the dead and in psychical research and different forms of parapsychology successfully lobbied the English government to get rid of these laws as a relic of the past. And once these laws were removed from the books, this tremendous opening was created. And into this opening stepped a man named Gerald Gardner, who was a retired member of the British Foreign Service. He was living on the southern coast of England. He had just an independent interest in folklore. And Gardner made the case that there was in Britain a surviving nature-based cult that represented the old nature-based religions of pre-Christian times. This was a controversial claim, and it's not altogether clear that it was true. But as a folklorist, Gardner maintained that there was this survival of what he called Wicca. His book was the which he published in 1951 called Witchcraft Today, was the book that brought us the modern usage of the term Wicca, which was an old Celtic term for clever folk, clever people. And he maintained that there was this practice of a beneficent nature-based witchcraft still existing in Great Britain that stretched all the way back to pre-Christian antiquity. And in his book, Witchcraft Today, he described being initiated into a modern coven. And people just embraced this book in Britain and in the United States and were entranced with it. They were very attracted to this idea of a nature-based, female-positive, sexually liberating spirituality. It tapped something that people were looking for on both sides of the Atlantic. So the repeal of these anti-witchcraft laws in Britain just created this a tremendous unleashing of energy and ideas. And the figure of Gerald Gardner is one of the people who's most largely responsible for creating a modern revival of Wicca, or what is sometimes called witchcraft.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, and my guest is Mitch Horowitz. He's author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. We're talking a little bit about Halloween. Now we're talking about witchcraft and Wicca. If you want to join the conversation, it will be along many lines. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, you mentioned that these traditions were pre-Christian, and is it clear that the anti-witch craze that lasted for so long was a way of getting rid of these pre-Christian pagan ritual type things, and the very strong female with a very strong female bent to them?
It was one way. The witch craze touched so many different nations in Europe, and it was a wave of paranoia and violence that lasted for so many centuries that it could have different causes in different locales. It's funny, one thinks of the witch trials as having ended by the Age of Enlightenment in the 1700s, but in fact, even in the 1780s, there was a rural housemaid in Switzerland who was accused of witchcraft, and she was tortured and beheaded, and this was well into what we call the Age of Enlightenment in a nation in the form of Switzerland that was a fairly prosperous place. So sometimes it's hard to understand the local paranoias that kept this going. But in late antiquity, when the pagan powers were fading and the church was rising to ascendancy, the church fathers promulgated a kind of historical myth that has continued to the current day, which is that people who were involved with the old nature-based forms of worship were somehow involved in black magic or Satanism or demon worship. And the truth is, no such tradition has ever existed in the West. You can look for it, but you won't find it other than in hearsay or accusation or suspect court testimony. It really wasn't there. It was a myth, and it got promulgated in the late ancient world. It continued to some extent through the Dark Ages, and it reemerged in the Middle Ages. Whenever there were local issues or paranoias or problems or grudges, this old myth would get trotted out, and it really seemed not to go away for centuries. It was so widespread from Poland to Switzerland to Great Britain to France that its causes were sometimes local, but it shows the power of a myth to get dusted off, reinvented, and reused when people are experiencing times of fear or paranoia.
Do you ever wonder about all the women that were killed? Powerful,
yes.
Powerful, strong female type people.
The numbers are really hard to grasp because obviously, you know, records weren't kept of these things.
Right.
Most of the accounts are anecdotal or matters of court testimony. And you know, it's been a question of controversy. People will sometimes debate the numbers. It's really hard to get our arms around it, but the loss is incalculable, just incalculable. And it's interesting, in America, of course, we had a spasm of anti-witchcraft violence in Salem, Massachusetts in the late 1600s. The remarkable thing is that was a relatively isolated case. There was always a spirit of a kind of religious independence in America, even back in the colonial days. There were so many contradictions to that,
mm-hmm.
but that ethic did hold sway. And what's surprising and remarkable in American history is that the witch craze never came here. Salem was a tragic, violent exception. There were acts of mob violence from time to time against people with alternative religious beliefs, including Mother Ann Lee, the founder of the Shakers. Mm-hmm. But Mother Ann fled from England because she didn't want to face charges of sorcery and witchcraft, even with, you know, Salem, as tragic as it was an exception in American history.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to speak with Mitch Horowitz, author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. Kevin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. My question for Mitch was, do these rituals, pre-Christian in the Celtic world, have any connection to the Druid religion?
That's a wonderful question, and again, it's like we're on our knees looking through a little tiny keyhole sometimes at the ancient world. It's very difficult for us to get a handle on precisely what the nature and the practice of the Druids were. I mean, pre-Christian times in the Celtic world encompass a period of perhaps 3,000 years of history. So it's very tough to wrap our hands around it. We know some of the rituals, like Swain, which became Halloween, but what has come down to us about the practice of the Druids or their actual religious doctrine is just very, very thin. It's too thin to say, I'm afraid.
I see. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Okay.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to All Sides with Dan Fisher Facebook page. My guest right now is Mitch Horowitz. He is the author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, President Obama goes on Comedy Central, Colbert and Jon Stewart march on Washington. We'll look at political humor, overtime, and right now. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point begins at 1 o'clock this afternoon right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. 47 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:19 this morning. Sunshine today, a few clouds in the afternoon, a high of 53 degrees. Clear skies tonight, we could see some frost after midnight and a little chilly, a low of 33. Areas of frost for Friday morning and then sunshine in the afternoon and a high right around 55. And looking ahead to Saturday, sunny skies and a high of 60 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Mitch Horowitz, author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. Mitch is also editor-in-chief at Tarcher Penguin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Erin, you want to talk about witches a little bit more. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I just wanted to ask and maybe point out, you know, David mentioned the Salem witch trials a couple of times there, and I have Wiccan friends, and they mention the Salem witch trials sometimes, you know, as like an incident of terrible, you know, it is terrible, you know, an instance in which a whole bunch of witches are killed, but none of the people killed in the Salem witch trials were actually witches.
Right.
Oh, that minor detail,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay. Good point. People were playing off of their darkened myths of witchcraft, and I think that's correct. The Salem witch trials were a story of local paranoia. They were also a story of a witch craze and an anti-witchery myth that had been carried over to America from the old world. That myth didn't really take root in America, which is why we talk about Salem as being an exception to the overall witch craze. But that's correct. I think that the people who were killed in Salem were targeted because of a variety of local feuds, because of a bad winter where crops had failed, because people were understandably frightened and even terrified that the community of Salem was not going to survive another winter, and they began to turn on each other. So there may have been a presence there may have been some spark of ignition due to the Afro-Caribbean, maybe voodoo-influenced practices of a woman in the community who was a slave who had been brought to the colonies from the Caribbean and who was practicing some African religious rituals in the home of one of the girls who was initially accused. Sometimes all it takes is just a little spark of ignition like that to set off a whole wave of paranoia, obviously. So that may have occurred at the inception of Salem, but it is absolutely a story of local paranoias and feuds and hatreds.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I just think it's interesting that it gets lumped in a lot, and I think, you know, I mean, I'm sure lots of folks who adhere to pagan beliefs in Europe and so on had been, you know, maybe wrongly tried and killed as witches along with lots of other people, but in Salem, it's really, yeah, I mean, I realize that, like, Tituba the slave kind of gets the ball rolling with some parlor tricks, but as near as I can tell, no actual witches were harmed during these.
Right, right. Lots of innocent folk, and of course, you know, had they been witches, they would have been innocent folk as well. But Salem's become a symbol, and the town today. I love Salem. It's an unusual place. It's become kind of a New Age mecca because people have come to see it as sort of a symbol and a gathering place for people with alternative religious beliefs. The television show Bewitched from the 1960s filmed a week of shows in Salem. they still have, in the local hotel, they still have monuments to the week that Elizabeth Montgomery and the cast of Bewitched lived there.
So, wow.
You know, the town in its own way is it's just a very eclectic place, and it's become this New Age capital because it's become kind of a symbol. But the events that occurred there during the violence of the late 1600s, they weren't spiritual in nature.
Thank you to Aaron for that question. We appreciate that. Mitch, music. We had you give us some ideas for some music to listen to that reference some element of tradition in mysticism in American culture. Let's hear Me and the Devil Blues, performed by Robert Johnson.
Devil was walking side by side. Me and the devil was walking side by side. And I'm going to be my woman until I get satisfied.
I love hearing that old music.
Yeah.
In any event, but there is that imagery of walking with the devil.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Robert Johnson, he was an interesting guy. He was taking ideas from an African American religious tradition, which still exists in this country, which is called hoodoo, not voodoo, but hoodoo with an H. Hoodoo was an African American slave tradition. It was a retention of some African religious beliefs from West Africa, Central Africa, areas that had been subjected to the slave trade. And hoodoo involved spells and rituals and the use of very ordinary household objects like perfumes and soaps and pins and needles and animal parts, wax, to try to create spells for things that were needful in life, like getting out of trouble with the law or getting money or getting one's girlfriend or husband back. And hoodoo was an African tradition and a slave tradition. It still continues in this country today. It's really, in many respects, a African-American religious belief system. And Johnson would very often make hoodoo references in his songs. Sometimes, as in the song that we just heard, he would combine those references with Christian language. In hoodoo, there was talk about going to a crossroads and casting a spell and being able to receive assistance from the dark man or some sort of a hidden shadowy man.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in Christian language, that figure would get conflated with the devil, but that is not how practitioners of hoodoo saw it. Practitioners of hoodoo were interested in incorporating the beliefs in certain African deities into America. And they had all kinds of different names for a hidden man or a shadow man or a dark man who was some kind of god or deity who would help you. But sometimes these things got bound up with Christian language, and Robert Johnson or other figures, sometimes in a playful way, would refer to that figure as the devil, but it didn't really connote or communicate any kind of satanic practice. There's a legend about Robert Johnson that he got his abilities in playing the guitar by going to a crossroads at night and asking the shadow man or the dark man to make an appearance and help him, and that is a tradition and a practice that you will sometimes find in hoodoo. I challenge the most hardened agnostic or atheist to go out at night and do that. They won't want to try.
Well, let's listen to Here's the Hoodoo Man by Junior Wells.
Lord, I wonder what's done got the matter. I try, you know I try. Seem like the hours, now everything will change while I hold up my hand. Lord, I'm trying to make my baby understand. Lord, you know, everybody tell me that somebody done hoodoo, the hoodoo man.
That was the Hoodoo Man by Junior Wells. Then there's Jimi Hendrix singing about Voodoo Child. Let's listen to that. Mitch, you know, you did mention it's African-American slave tradition. I mean, it's no – we also have the song Superstition by Stevie Wonder. I mean, This is an ongoing theme.
Yeah. You know, and an interesting thing to point out, and this is something that these artists were aware of, is that voodoo and hoodoo are completely different, and they should always be distinguished. Voodoo is an Afro-Caribbean tradition. It's a religion with a priesthood, with a doctrine, with deities, and it's practiced in the Caribbean heavily in Haiti. It traveled to the United States to some extent. Hoodoo, with an H, is really a homegrown African-American tradition.
Okay.
It began in North America. It came to America with slave ships. No one is quite sure where the word hoodoo came from. There was a West African tribe called the Hausa, and they had a word called huduba, which meant to trick or to frustrate or to foil somebody. Sometimes in hoodoo, you'll cast a spell to maybe get rid of a troublesome or noisy neighbor or get out of trouble with the police or something like that. So the word hoodoo may have come from the West African word huduba, to trick or to foil. But the two traditions are very different.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And, Neil, you're on the air. You want to talk about that Celtic tradition of Halloween?
Well, I come from a very Irish background. My last name's Murphy. And talking to Grandma and Great-Grandma, they didn't really have the thought that dark spirits were bad.
Mm-hmm.
If you appease them and they were on your side, you could use them against your enemies, or somebody did something bad to you, you could call on them.
And that's
and
not
I
bad?
Wondered,
yeah.
Well, no.
Okay.
I wonder what your guest had to say about that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I've found the same belief system in my background. I grew up in a fairly traditional Jewish household, but there were these ideas from the old country that spirits and powers existed and they could be harnessed by the individual, not necessarily in a bad way, but that was just part of the nature of life. That's the whole idea behind occult traditions, that there's this invisible world, there's this unseen world, and its powers can be appealed to, can be felt on us and through us. You know, it's funny, all these different traditions, Irish folklore, Jewish folklore, African-American folklore, they all get mixed together in surprising ways, and you never quite know where something comes from. In hoodoo, for example, there is a practice that if you don't want it to rain, you can take an axe and go out and do a ceremony outside as if you're chopping at the clouds. You're chopping away the clouds. And the axe is a symbol that was possessed by an African deity named Chango. And you sometimes find the figure of Chango in hoodoo. You sometimes find him in Santeria. He sometimes gets conflated with Saint Barbara, actually, in Santeria. Santeria would marry African deities to Catholic saints. Anyway, so I've read accounts of people going outside their house, in particular one African-American woman in the antebellum years, outside her cabin in Mississippi, trying to chop away at the clouds to appease Chango and then slamming the axe into the ground. Now, I grew up in my Jewish background with a folklore belief that if it was going to rain and you didn't want it to rain, you'd take a knife and stick the knife in the ground. Now, there's no way that those two traditions don't have some connection.
That's interesting.
Yeah, what probably happened is it came into Jewish folklore through hoodoo. You know, people copy from one another. People inherit things, borrow things, repurpose things. That's the whole story of our religious history in the West in general and in America in particular. We love borrowing things cross-culturally. So it was only years later where I read the story about this woman, you know, doing this hoodoo ritual that I connected it with the idea that I grew up with, of putting a knife into the ground.
Well, in the Irish folklore, you didn't call and ask for help unless you needed it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you did, you'd be punished.
Mm.
And
if you asked for it when you didn't need it, you'd be punished.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
You know, if somebody stole a penny from you and that was immaterial and you called and asked for help, you would be the be punished for it.
Mm.
Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't, but it sounds like a good rule to live by. You know? You don't have a fire alarm unless there's fire. Yeah.
All righty. Neil, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Mitch Horowitz. He is author of Occult America. It is The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. We have an email from a listener. My birthday is November 1st, All Saints Day. I am not superstitious and do not think this has any occult or whatever significance. But were there occult or other types of sects in the past or even still today who believe that people with a birthday on Halloween or All Saints Day have some type of occult power or influence?
Well, that is a belief that's out there, I guess. She will just have to test that out in her lived experience. It's interesting that the practice of Swain, the ancient version of Halloween, was really an overnight practice. It began on the evening of October 31st, and it carried over into November 1st. And in the Middle Ages, All Saints Day was practiced in the exact same way. So, in some ways, you know, it's like this borderline holiday. The date is neither quite October 31st nor quite November 1st. You know, and that celebrates the principle of the holiday, which is that it's supposed to mark a crossing over from fall into winter, and an honoring of the crossing over from life to death. So, you know, people who were born at that time, I think, in traditional terms, would be considered people who are sort of born in between the two worlds, the physical world that we live in and the invisible world. That's the tradition.
You know, another tradition coming up on Election Day, it so happens this year, is the Day of the Dead.
Yeah.
And I know it's more a Mexican tradition, but it's growing in popularity in the United States as well.
Yes, yeah. It's remarkable. You know, in Mexico and in other Latin American countries, they make no division between the practice of Catholicism and the practice of certain folkloric and occult traditions. Actually, right now I'm carrying in my pocket a saint card of a folk saint in the Catholic Church named Saint Expedite. He's supposed to be a figure that you pray to when you want to get things done in a hurry or when you need help in a hurry. The hierarchy of the Catholic Church doesn't recognize St. Expedite. They consider him sort of an invention of folklore. But you can actually walk into churches in Mexico, in Puerto Rico, or in other parts of the Caribbean or Latin America, and find statues to St. Expedite and offerings to St. Expedite. So, you know, traditions like Santeria, for example, that marry Catholic saints to African deities, and Santeria is very popular in the Caribbean, in certain parts of Latin America, and certain parts of North America. You know, these things are not exceptional in Mexico. You know, celebrations that mark the that honor the ancestors, that seek to contact the spirits of the dead, that honor folk saints like Saint Expedite. You know, they coexist with Catholicism. The occult and traditional religion coexist. You know, in a way that is very seamless in Mexico, and the Day of the Dead is one indication of that.
And it is another example of how something starts to get embraced.
Yes.
By another culture.
Yes. You know, it's funny, these things, they just, you know, as we were, you know, speaking before with Mr. Murphy, these mm-hmm. ideas, they just travel. They travel across cultures. It's absolutely remarkable. You know, for example, in America, when the whole spiritualist movement started up in the mid-19th century, which involved seances and spirit raps and mm-hmm. talking to the dead, that movement traveled to France and started to crop up in Paris in the early 1850s. They call it spiritism. One of the most popular French spiritualist figures was a guy named Alan Kardec. In certain Spanish-speaking urban areas of North America today and in Latin America, you can buy candles, vigil candles, that honor the image and the memory of Alan Kardec. He was enshrined on a stamp in the nation of Brazil. You can find prayer cards to Alan Kardec. He's become this kind of spiritualist saint. And, you know, the movement of spiritualism started in upstate New York. It traveled. It was probably America's first religious export. It traveled to England and France. Kardec embraces it. And, you know, because of Portuguese traders, his image and his ideas get spread throughout Latin America. And so suddenly, you know, you can walk into an American, you know, a spiritual shop in an American city today, find a candle to Alan Kardec that was imported from Mexico. But these are ideas that actually re-entered America from the spiritualist movement that began in upstate New York. So this is just the cycle of religious history. Things get borrowed and repurposed all the time, and they come back to us in unusual ways.
Yeah, it is a cycle, and I want to talk about that when we return. My guest is Mitch Horowitz, author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get a fresh perspective on the news with Capital City Radio, an HD radio service from WOSU. Start your day with the takeaway and be a part of the American conversation. Or get a global perspective with PRI's The World. Enjoy a blend of old and new music with insightful news and talk programs. Listen to Capital City Radio on HD3 89.7 FM or online at capitalcityradio.org.
Support for WOSU comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts, presenting Leanne Rimes, touring in support of her upcoming release, Lady and Gentleman, Sunday, November 7th at the McCoy Center for the Arts in New Albany. Details at mccoycenter.org.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here with a discussion of the history and significance of cemeteries in American life. Graveyards figure prominently in scary movies, yet cemeteries are also places of solace and beauty. All Sides with Ann Fisher at 11 o'clock on WOSU 820 NPR News. And it's 48 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Clouds today and some sunshine, a high of 53. Clear skies tonight. It'll get a little chilly overnight, a low of 33 degrees. Areas of frost for Friday morning, sunshine in the afternoon, and a high of 55. All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Mitch Horowitz, author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. Mitch, several interesting characters fill your book. I mean, it's a book about people more than anything, and what they did and how they. One of them emerged during the Great Depression, though. I actually want to talk about a couple of them, but the first is Frank B. Robinson,
yeah.
the mail order prophet, and the title, and it is amazing. Tell us about him and what made him special.
Frank Robinson is really one of my favorite figures in the book. He was a pharmacist who worked in the town of Moscow, Idaho, in the 1920s, and he was such a consummate American figure. He was a guy who was casting around for religious meaning in his life. He had been kicked out of Bible school. He had enlisted in the Salvation Army. He had tried out all the different Christian denominations, and he was unsatisfied. And one day he went to his room and closed the door after attending a depressing, poorly attended church service. And as he was sitting in his room, he said he just felt the power of the divine just completely infusing him, as if it was coursing through his veins and the tissues of his body. And he came to a philosophy that we would basically understand as positive thinking. He had this mystical experience, and he came to believe that the human mind was a channel of divine will, and that with the proper use and the proper understanding, we could actually outpicture the images and the desires of our mind into concrete reality. So he founded his own religion, very American thing to do, and he called it Psychiana. And he came up with this interesting wrinkle. This was in 1929. He decided that he couldn't go around the country promoting and speaking on behalf of Psychiana, because he had a job, he had a wife and children, he had needs to attend to at home. So he decided to make it into a mail order religion. And he started taking out national advertising, which was still a fairly new and revolutionary thing to do in the late 1920s. And his ads were just absolutely audacious. They said, "I talked with God, and so can you. Here's how to learn how." And you could clip a coupon, send him in a few bucks, and get a whole mail order study course in the practice of what he called Psychiana, or what we would understand as the power of positive thinking.
It's amazing how many people responded to that immediately.
Absolutely astonishing. During the Great Depression, he probably had, for a period of a few years, millions of followers. Psychiana arguably could have been considered the eighth largest religion on earth at one time. And yet, after his death in 1948, the movement was completely forgotten. You'll be lucky if you ever meet anybody who's heard of Psychiana or who knows the name Frank B. Robinson. The faith was all based around his personality, his philosophy, his insights. And after he was gone, his books and his ideas disappeared. There was really no church or congregational structure. But he issued a challenge to the mainstream congregations, which is that religion had to address the daily problems of domestic life. It had to address people's money problems, relationship problems, addiction problems. That's what people were finding in Frank Robinson's message. He said religion can be used as a practical source of healing. And although he was condemned from mainstream pulpits, after his death, a lot of mainstream pulpits started using his methods, including media outreach, mail order courses, and they started taking a kind of practical therapeutic tone. Norman Vincent Peale described Christianity as a practical, usable way of life. I tell you, those words were a direct echo of Frank B. Robinson.
It's interesting. He revolutionized the mail order idea. That was his.
Yep.
No one had ever done that before. It also did him in, because he never really profited much from this.
No. In fact, it's so funny because people called him a religious racketeer, and they said, mm-hmm. This is just a gold mine. This guy is just raking in the dough. I have really gone over the surviving financial records, and the truth is the man made a decent living, but he lived a fairly ordinary middle-class lifestyle. He had a four-square brick home in the town of Moscow, Idaho. He made the salary of a middling white-collar manager, and he wasn't a racketeer. He really sincerely believed this, and he folded most of his money back into his business, because Psychiana was sustained by advertising and mail order marketing.
And of course, that became more expensive and not as lucrative.
Yeah,
ultimately,
it became more expensive, and to a very great extent, toward the end of his life, some of the mainstream congregations began to adapt his methods.
Uh-huh.
Only 4 years after his death, Norman Vincent Peale published his landmark book, The Power of Positive Thinking.
Right.
And by that point, this philosophy was just found everywhere.
And now, one gentleman that he hooked up with for a time thought he should start a church, you know, with the congregation and that sort of a thing, but he just never really went for it.
No, you know, Robinson was never really able to form a congregational structure. He didn't want to lead a flock. He wanted to write his books. He wanted to advertise. He wanted to write his mail order courses. He didn't want to train deputies or proteges. He didn't want to get into the day-to-day issues of managing a faith, which is why that when he died, his religion died with him.
We have an email now. If someone would like to email us, go to allsides@wosu.org, and you can also call us at 614-292-8513. My guest is Mitch Horowitz, author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. We have an email now from Glenn. He gets into a topic I want to talk about as well. He writes, I really enjoyed the book. It encourages further research on the part of the reader. There are many charlatans and Elmer Gantries portrayed in your book, but Edgar Cayce is treated very respectfully. He never profited from his work, which he did to the detriment of his own health. Still a mystery how he did what he did. Could you talk a bit more about him? And I wanted to talk about him, too. You said he was the highest legacy of a cult in America.
I believe so. Cayce was a medical clairvoyant who lived and worked in the late 19th and the first half of the 20th centuries. And he would go into a trance state from which he was said to be able to diagnose and prescribe cures for the illnesses of people who he had never met or, in many cases, who lived many hundreds of miles away. Cayce was a remarkable figure on many scales, and the email from your listener touches on a number of them. He lived most of his life in a state of near poverty. It's very typical for us to associate spiritualism and claims of psychical powers with somebody getting rich, somebody raking in the dough from naive followers. Edgar Cayce would do readings for free all the time. He had a huge waiting list of people who were appealing to him. Ostensibly, he charged $20, but there are many records of him accepting $1, doing a reading for free, deferring payment. So he and his family lived in a state of poverty for much of his life. Cayce, in his psychical readings, whatever their source was and whatever the nature of these readings were, he popularized so many things in American life that today are just part of the vernacular of daily existence. For example, in the 1930s, Cayce was the first American to prescribe meditation for an actual clinical purpose of de-stressing and relaxation. Cayce was probably the primary person in this country who popularized the idea of reincarnation or past lives. Cayce pioneered certain ideas in the relationship between stress and illness. In many ways, he's considered the grandfather of natural medicine and stress reduction. These were things that popped up again and again in these trance readings of his. And he was an uneducated guy who grew up in rural Kentucky in the late 19th century. There was also a tremendous ethic that ran through the Cayce readings. Most of his readings were medical in nature, but some of them were psychological. And when he would get into addressing somebody's psychological needs or neurosis, he had this mixture of therapeutic and religious-based language that today is very, very familiar to us in things like Alcoholics Anonymous, mm-hmm. or various 12-step movements. This idea that religion and the concepts of the Bible could be an actual source of healing to neurosis, to issues of self-esteem, relationship problems, just abounded in Cayce's psychological readings. He would always direct people to a set of universal religious ethics and talk about how these things had psychological applications. So I think in the example of Cayce, both in how he lived his life and in how he popularized ideas ranging from meditation to natural health to the psychological benefits of religious ethics, he was a pioneer. I think he was the greatest figure in my view to come out of the occult tradition in America.
There was a fellow who was a racist I can't remember the
William Dudley Pelly.
And he didn't understand Casey's reading to him when he went to him with his troubles, and Casey's reading to him was an ethical reading, and he then referred him to another gentleman in New York who was Jewish.
Yes.
And tell me, I wasn't sure what the outcome of that, how did that worked for them?
Oh, that's interesting. Actually, there was an occult neo-Nazi figure in America named William Dudley Pelly, who burst onto the public scene in the late 1920s and early 1930s. It was a follower of Pelly's who went to Edgar Casey for a reading. The man had been in a car accident, and he was unable to work, and he was experiencing just profound difficulties in his life, both in terms of his physical health and his inability to support his family. This was exactly the kind of figure who approached Edgar Casey again and again. So in the early 1940s, shortly before Casey's death, this man approached him and asked him to give him what was known as a past life reading. Part of Casey's theology was that he could go into a trance state and read into somebody's past lives and use those experiences to define their present-day neuroses. That's not a widely accepted practice today, although you find it a lot within the New Age and within alternative spiritual circles. Casey looked into this man's life, and not knowing anything about him, he said, you have to live life in an ethical way. You know, you're living as a thief. You're visiting hatred onto other people. And the man was dissatisfied with the reading, and Casey encouraged the man to go to New York and speak with a friend of Casey's named David Kahn, who was a Jewish man and a furniture manufacturer who Casey had met when the two of them were growing up together in Kentucky. And it's not clear. There are no records that exist of that man actually approaching Dave Kahn or if that exchange ever taking place. But it was typical of Casey. He wouldn't say things to accommodate people or to please people. He wouldn't kowtow to people. He wouldn't tell them what they wanted to hear. I write about this reading and this encounter in the book, and it was very typical of Casey. Mm-hmm. He would challenge people and not accommodate them.
He was very poor. What's his legacy? Is he still well recognized and well regarded generally?
I think he is. He established an organization called the Association for Research and Enlightenment. It's funny you bring it up because they're an active New Age and spiritual therapeutic.
Still down in Virginia Beach, right?
Virginia Beach.
Yeah.
I was just there about 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
They have a yearly Ancient Mysteries Conference, and there was a huge gathering there. It was wonderful. And amazingly enough, and this is talk about the Casey legacy, the primary speaker who was present at this conference in Virginia Beach a couple of weeks ago was a man named Zahi Hawass, who is a famous archaeologist, and he is the Minister of Antiquities in Egypt. Hawass is not a supporter of any of Casey's views of alternative history. Casey spoke about Atlantis and there being a secret hall of records buried underneath the Sphinx. Hawass wants nothing to do with any of that. He's a critic and he's a skeptic of those ideas. But he came to the Edgar Casey Center because when he was a very young man, Edgar Casey's son, Hugh Lynn Casey, identified Hawass as this very promising, intelligent, uniquely effortful figure, and he helped finance Hawass's education. And that man today is the Minister of Antiquities in Egypt, and even though he is a skeptic and a critic of the Casey material, he believes in giving back. And 40 years later, he came and spoke at this conference just 2 weeks ago at the Edgar Casey Foundation in Virginia Beach.
It's interesting, too, that a lot of what Edgar Casey prescribed to people for different physical ailments, they've maintained records of all of that.
That's right. Casey gave more than 14,000 records, 14,000 readings in his lifetime. Many of them were medical in nature. And there were fairly extensive files kept of correspondence between Casey and people who received the readings. I mean, hundreds, if not thousands, of people testified to the effectiveness of Casey's readings. Now, you know, a lot of this is anecdotal testimony.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't stand up to scientific scrutiny, but it's what we've got. These are records that are primarily based in correspondence between Casey and different individuals. And as a set of anecdotal records, the data is extraordinary. You had many, many people who came back to Casey for repeat readings who claimed that his prescriptions and cures had helped them with diseases that had resisted years of treatment. It's probably probably the most extraordinary anecdotal record of its kind. It's the best we've got, and the readings were and the correspondence were very scrupulously kept, basically as medical case files.
We only have a few more minutes, Mitch, but you, in your epilogue, you talk about the dawn of the new age in the 50s, you know, with the Wiccan movement, and then it's underscored in the 60s, the age of Aquarius.
Yeah.
You said that the new age has a core set of beliefs. I wondered if you could give us a rundown of those. Again, we only have a few minutes, but...
Sure, absolutely. Primarily a belief in the therapeutic quality of religious experiences. A belief that in some way or another, our thoughts outpicture into reality, a belief that human consciousness is capable of growth, of expansion, a basic belief in the universal validity of all religions, and above all, perhaps, a belief that the individual can reach some kind of higher truth, some kind of higher principle without belonging to any one individual religious movement. Those are probably the core beliefs that would define the New Age.
And that's not uncommon. Many people embrace that.
That's right. You know, those ideas, when you call them New Age, people want to run away from them. But if you take away all the labels and say, well, you agree with the majority of these statements, most Americans, I think, would say, yes, I agree.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Mitch Horowitz, for joining us today again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mitch is the author of Occult America. It's a secret history of how mysticism shaped our nation. He's also editor-in-chief at Tarsier Penguin. You can reach him online. I think I have a link to him on Facebook at All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we'll have a link to his book on our webpage as well at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks again. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.